emails asking, oh, well, my friend's in a Tuesday at 2 o'clock too. Do I go to their room? No, there are like 4 sections at any given time. So if you're in the to be announced 1 o'clock section today, that's in Seaver 110. If you're in the to be announced for 2 o'clock today, please come up to the front afterwards because there's 2 to be announced at that time and we'll give you your section assignment. If you're in the Quincy Bullet Room at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, it said boardroom, it's the bullet room. That's downstairs in the basement. Thursday at 1 o'clock, if it's to be announced, you're in William James Hall, room 1305. Thursday at 2 o'clock, if it's to be announced, you're in William James Hall, 1305. And I think that's it. Nope. Wednesday at 11, if it's to be announced, you're in room 1305 in William James Hall. Does everyone have that? Yeah? If you have any questions, just come see me after class. You good? Okay.
Hi, good morning. Good morning. Hi. So we're having a little bit of problems with the display. Hopefully it will work. If not, I'll have to do. So before we jump into the material, again, a few questions. And by the way, I've decided I will ask you each personally if it's okay for me to mention your name, because some of you I know feel uncomfortable and it may dissuade you from writing. So I will not use your name unless I ask you to. So there is no tacit consent, in other words. But there is consent here from Rachel. From Rachel Pollack, who asked a very interesting question. And to answer this question, I'd like to also solicit some of your answers, or for you to think about it. And the question is, we talked about the environment doesn't making that much of a difference, except for, remember, extreme conditions such as extreme poverty, political oppression. And the question that Rachel brought up, which is an important one, is, so what about Harvard? You know, what about this environment where we are? You know, the Crimson article that we talked about that talked about Harvard having a lot of people who are unhappy. So is there something, am I doing this or? Anyone here who took CS51? Why isn't it working?
I don't know.
So, do you have a laptop here?
I can have one run over immediately if you'd like to.
Yeah.
Do you want to call? I'll place a call over. Now, I'm not sure what's going on.
So any computer specialist here, someone who knows, I think it has to do with the configuration of the display. Any volunteers? No? Sorry? Has to do with this.
Yeah. You try pretty much every input on it, so.
All All right, let me try once more.
Yeah, we can try the interface in the back.
Oh.
It may just be a bad input up here, too, even. It might just not be your laptop, so.
Yeah.
Aside from the input in the rear, I don't think this one's going to come to life. No, that's not happening at the moment. Yeah,
okay.
I don't think it's going to...
All right, it's not going to happen. So do you want to try in the back, or...? Forget it. Forget it. I'm not going to work. Okay. We're going to have to go back to the dark ages and work without PowerPoint today. It's going to be very hard, but we'll have to make do. How many of you, by the way, printed the PowerPoints? Just so I get a sense. Okay, three of you. That's good. Fine. All right, so to get your input into this, why do you think, or what is it about Harvard? Why do you think there is, and I'm not sure there is, because there isn't rigorous research on it. You know, it was a Crimson article. Why do you think there are many people who are unhappy here, and what is it about the environment, maybe or maybe not, that leads to anxiety, stress, unhappiness, whatever it is, here at Harvard? Again, and we talked about the fact that it's probably not the weather, again, unless for cases of, you know, seasonal affective disorder, SAD. So what do you think it is? Yeah. Sorry? It can be very lonely, but in what why? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, so there's too much to do, people don't have much time to spend with their friends, and there is loneliness as a result of it. So it could be, you know, the schedule. Good. What else? Yes. So there's a lot of self-selection. Okay. you know, joke aside, I think, you know, the question is, what does the environment do versus what does it attract? That's a good point. Yes. Mm-hmm. So people are too focused on the future, don't know how to relax and have fun, and that maybe has to do with some of the self-selection issue.
Vasco.
Right, so what you're saying, let me paraphrase and tell me if this is right, that, you know, until coming here, we were always getting all the rewards, all the awards, we were always, you know, the best, and suddenly we come here and everyone is the best. So by the law of averages, there has to be a curve, and we're no longer as successful, relatively speaking, relative to the people here, as we were before, and we often compare ourselves to the immediate group, as opposed to saying, well, in high school I was the best, who cares about now? No, we usually compare it to the present. Is this good? Yes. So what Bora is saying is that it's both probably the person and the situation. The person is self-selection. Many of us are perfectionists. You know, what Bora is saying is that we got here to a great extent because we are perfectionist, and I will talk a lot about that when in my lecture on perfectionism. At the same time, because everyone is that way, this is the model that we have. Everyone does it, or most people do it. And remember the power of priming, the power of the environment, that what we see in front of us very often is internalized and becomes the schema. So it's both. Anything else? Sorry, I forgot you up there. Yeah. Right, so the self-esteem issue, it's connected to what Vasco said earlier in terms of our self-esteem could have relied to a great extent on the fact that we are better, that we're good, that we're successful, whereas here, it's no longer the case because everyone is exceptional. That's how you got here in the first place. So we no longer can base our self-esteem on doing well externally, at least not in the environment here. And we'll talk about it when we talk about self-esteem. There are different types of self-esteem. One self-esteem which is contingent on other people, on how we're doing relative to other people, and yet there is also self-esteem that's independent. And the question is, the challenge is to develop this independent core. And we'll talk a lot about that, yeah. Right, you know, this is an important point. We all got here mostly by working hard and by working hard ourselves. No one can work hard for you. And we come here and we follow the same model. Well, I've dealt with issues in the past, I'm gonna deal with issues here, even though this is a different environment, more stressful environment, and we fail to look for help externally. And help could come in the form of talking to our friends about it. Remember, instead, very often what we do is we fall into the great deception. Oh, everything is fine, everything is great. Or help, professional help. You know, the Bureau of Study Council, what an amazing resource. What a luxury to have it. But we don't want to seek help because the model has always been, I can do it myself. Good, yes. A lot less physical, personal space, because especially usually our first 2 years were with roommates. Even if we have our own room, it's still being with people in a similar space. There was no real privacy. I never thought of that, but it absolutely could have something to do with it. Absolutely. I mean, I know that I've experienced this in section. It took me a long time to muster up the courage and say something because everyone is so smart, I don't want to look stupid. And we're going to talk about that today because this is a key issue, this fear of failure that we all have, especially in this environment that seemingly doesn't support, certainly doesn't celebrate, and doesn't have a lot of failure. Sleep. You're showing the syllabus, right? This class is taught at 11:30 for a reason. Sleep is very important. And we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna have a whole lecture talking about the mind-body connection, where we talk about the importance of sleep, the importance of exercise. Good. Yeah. Yeah. All right, so what Maslow would say, and I think this is a very good paraphrase, is how can we turn this situation into something positive? And it's interesting that you mentioned, because after reading Maslow, I thought about the same thing, and I said, coming back here for grad school, you know, as an undergrad, my first 2 years were just not good. I did not have a good time. I was stressed. I fell into the, you know, this rat race. The environment really affected me. I also came in with certain predispositions, you know, toward perfectionism. My last 2 years were pretty good. I had a good junior year and a good senior year. Also, I was older than the average undergrad because I did the military before. So, you know, a little bit more perspective in terms of, you know, being 3 years in quote unquote real world, but still there was a lot of stress. And when I came back for grad school, I said to myself, if I can maintain my calm at Harvard, I can maintain it anywhere. It was actually an objective that I set to myself beyond, you know, getting my dissertation and whatever. And this is a real challenge. And this is an idea that we'll talk about a lot throughout this semester, about cognitive restructuring. How can we take a difficult situation and turn it around and say, okay, so this is my challenge right now. I want to be able to maintain calm even here, even at Harvard, even where there is so much failure to fear of failure, even where there are so many perfectionists, even with my perfectionist tendencies. How do I change that all around? And in many ways, I mean, I could, you put, you know, you said it better than I can, but I could say this is what this class is about. Being able to change, use Harvard as an opportunity. So this is what we'll try and do. I'm going to try one more thing here, because I'm optimistic that it's still gonna work. Does anyone know the function that brings back the settings to, let's say, 48 hours ago? Yeah. Yeah. Is that going to blow up my computer? Do you want to do it? Do you want to try? Sorry? Yeah. I just did. I won't hold it against you if it blows up, don't worry. So let me say a few words. Let me say a few words about the question that Rachel brought up, because it is so important. And by the way, Harvard will not be the last place where you'll experience it, because many of you will then go to jobs where the best people are going to, whether it's through recruiting or personal jobs, you'll be in high positions, and your peer group will be highly successful people. So you will have all these challenges that you didn't have earlier, perhaps. So there are a few things I want to say about it. First of all, this environment here there is a lot of pressure. The pressure very often is self-induced, but there is a lot of pressure, especially given that everyone else is under pressure, and what we are primed by are other people's behaviors. What we are primed by is what we read about, whether it's in the Crimson. It's the competition that is constantly here. And remember, even if people just saw flashing on a screen, you know, certain pictures, it already primed them to behave in a certain way, whether it was to walk slower. Remember that study? So imagine if we're constantly bombarded with competition, with hard work, with pressure, comparison, constantly. Of course it's going to affect us. And the question is, how do we, develop a stronger internal core, which we're going to talk about also today, but second, how are we going to be able to create a better environment for ourselves? And one of the things, you know, you do it through meditation. What's meditation? Meditation is withdrawing for a while, you know, sitting down, closing one's eyes, having, you know, either, you know, just as quiet space as possible, and just relaxing. In other words, reprogramming the priming that we get, the pressure that we get from outside. Also exercise. You know, that's many of you I know exercise, you know, with your Walkman on. And you just listen to music and you withdraw for a while. And that helps reprime our mind. So, other things. You're stealing the what? The computer? Do see.
You want me to email it to my computer?
What, the program? Okay. If you have a, I have a memory stick, maybe you can do it. It's all right. We're, you know, class is almost over, so. That's one thing. The other thing I want to say is, and this is a question that Vasco, you brought up before, the idea of internal versus external drives. We're very much driven by externals. Now, we have been, because this is what our culture focuses on, and we have been from a very young age, and it worked for us to a great extent when we were here. But now, yeah, we're still here, but everyone is here. And the external no longer satisfies us. And eventually, it can't satisfy anyone. So even if you remained in any environment, the external can't satisfy us for long. It can only take us so far in terms of our happiness. And the question is, how do we turn this external to the internal? How are we able to refocus instead of on getting the next raise, getting the best grades, getting the best job? Not throw it away, keep it there, but shift the pendulum so that we change it to, how can I find what is most meaningful to me? How can I find what I'm most passionate about? How can I find what gives me purpose, what my calling is? Wait a moment. Now. It's really trying hard. Don't give up. So let me begin. So remember last time what we talked about was the self-help movement and how it was able to identify the power of the mind and bring it to the masses. Remember, whatever you conceive you can achieve, Napoleon Hill. And the question we asked is there a scientific foundation for that? And the answer was that to a great extent, not fully, but to a great extent, yes. And the answer to it came through the work on self-efficacy by Albert Bandura from Stanford University, who showed that self-efficacy determines our levels of happiness to a great extent, that it determines our level of long-term success, resilience, motivation. And what he said most importantly is that we can cultivate. Self-efficacy. And then Nathaniel Brandon's work also saying the same thing. Another research that shows how self-efficacy can actually help is the work on the the power of the mind, is the placebo effect. The placebo effect, you know, very simple, you go to the doctor, you have a headache, you ask for a pill, she tells you, this pill will really alleviate your pain immediately, it's the latest. It's actually just a sugar pill, you take it, but you actually feel better as a result, the placebo. Well, the person who's done the most work on the placebo effect is a professor at the Harvard Medical School, Herbert Benson. He has a few famous books. One of them is The Relaxation Response, where he talks about the effects of meditation. Another one, the one that I'm drawing on now, is Timeless Healing, where he talks about the placebo effect. Let me share with you just two of the experiments that he discusses there. He took in a group of women as a medical doctor who were pregnant and who had stomach problems. They were nauseous, they were throwing up, common for pregnant women at the beginning of the pregnancy. He brought them in to his clinic and gave them a pill which he said will help them alleviate their nausea, it will help stop the vomiting. It was a placebo drug. They took the drug and they got better. He then went a step further. He brought another group of women with the same stomach problems. Brought them in, and this time he gave them Ipecac. Now, those of you who know what Ipecac is a medication that is supposed to make you throw up. So if you have food poisoning, you take Ipecac, it makes you throw up. In other words, now he didn't give them in a quantity where it was dangerous, of course. It went through all the ethical boards and everything. So it was safe, but he still gave them Ipecac, telling them that this medication was going to make them better. Stop throwing up and stop feeling nauseous. So they took this Ipecac, which was supposed to make them feel worse, and their vomiting stopped, and they actually felt better. The power of the mind. Let me read you an excerpt from his book, Timeless Healing. He writes, "Remarkably, the patient's nausea and vomiting ceased entirely, and their stomach contractions, as measured through the balloons, returned to normal. Because they believed they received anti-nausea medicine, the women reversed the proven action of a powerful drug. Even though many of us stock our medicine cabinets and first aid kits with Ipecac to bring about vomiting in case of poisoning, these pregnant women with documented stomach distress thwarted the action of a drug that should have made them even sicker. With beliefs alone, they cured themselves." This is amazing. Now, this doesn't mean that medicine doesn't have an effect. It doesn't mean that if a doctor gives you a placebo cyanide and tells you it will make you feel better, it will. It will not. You know, obviously medication has an effect. But, as Herbert Benson said, what medicine has done, mainly Western medicine, has done is ignore, to a great extent, an important pillar of well-being, which is here. Yeah, medicine is important, and that's an important pillar. But no less important, sometimes more important, is the mind, the power of the mind, the power of beliefs, as self-fulfilling prophecies. I believe that it will work, it is likely to work. Instead, if you read literature on medicine, very often the placebo is discarded. Oh, well, it means it doesn't really work. Placebo is a key issue, showing the power of the mind. Now, the question that I asked myself and researchers in the field ask themselves is, why does it work? How can you explain the power of the mind? What's the mechanism? And as psychologists, as teachers, and as individuals who want to implement this idea, it's important to understand. So what I was interested in understanding was how beliefs or expectations influence our performance. What I was interested in was what is the mediator. What comes here? We know that beliefs affect performance. We know the 4-minute mile. We know Marva Collins. She believes and it affects her, the performance of her kids. We know the placebo effect. What comes here? There are a few answers to this. Let me focus on two that I think are the main ones that account for most of the variance, according to research. The first one is motivation. Levels of motivation. We know that if we believe that we can do well, and think back to a time when you believe that you could really do well, you know, we're more pumped up, we work harder, and that in turn will affect our performance, both before in terms of our preparation and also during the performance itself. This is what Marva Collins does to a great extent. She motivates her students. You can do it, it's up to you. Don't blame others, take responsibility. I believe in you. And that influences their performance. But here's another thing that influences, the second mechanism that accounts for a lot of the variance, and that is our mind's need for consistency. Our mind's need for consistency. What does that mean? Well, we all have a mental schema of the world. I have a mental schema, for example, of the fact that if I let go of something, it will drop, the law of gravity. I have a schema of other people. I have a schema of this person being nice and this person being not so nice. That's a schema, a belief, an expectation that I have. That's all in here. I also have a schema about my performance in math, how good I am at math, or in the humanities as a writer. I have all these schemas here. And then there is the outside world, where if I let go of this, it actually does fall down. That's the outside world, independent of my schema. Certain people behave nicely toward others. Others do not, independent of my schema. I do well or poorly on a math test, independent of my schema. In other words, there is my schema, the internal, and the outside world, the external. Now, here is the key issue here. The mind doesn't like when there is inconsistency or incongruence between the internal and the external. It wants them to be on the same level. It doesn't like when there is inconsistency between the two. The idea of cognitive dissonance. We feel dis-ease when they're not matching. And there are a few things that the mind will do to make sure that there is consistency between the two. Because you see, there is constant dialogue. There are a few things that the mind will do in order to make sure that there is a consistency. One thing that it can do is update the schema. In other words, I had a notion that this person was not nice. I see them behaving generously, benevolently, and nicely toward other people. I update my schema. Now I think that person is nice. There was a disconnect. Now they're the same again. The more common mechanism is not to update the schema. The more common mechanism to ensure consistency is ignoring the outside world, or discarding information. So I see that person behaving nicely, I ignore it. And what I do is look for confirming evidence. I look for confirming evidence instead of updating my schema. Why? Because I don't like when there is inconsistency. So one way to do it is to say, okay, I was wrong, and then there is consistency again. Another thing to do is to ignore, discard, or look for confirming evidence to verify why my beliefs are right. And then once I verify it, there is consistency again, and I'm happy. The dis-ease, the dissonance is gone. And there is another thing that we do. We actually create a reality that ensures that there is a consistency between the two. What happened before April 1954 with the 4-minute mile? The schema was that it was impossible to run it under 4 minutes. And what did all the runners do, believing in it? They actually created a reality where they showed that this was not the case, that it was impossible. In order to ensure a consistency, even though they had the potential in them to do it, and believe me, they weren't running around the track and saying, wait, we're over the speed limit. They were trying as hard as they could to break the 4-minute barrier, but they didn't believe it was possible, and they created the reality where it wasn't possible. Comes along Roger Bannister, and shatters the fortress. breaks that schema, creates a new schema, and suddenly it is possible, and now a different reality is created. Think about it. How often do we look for confirming evidence? We see it a lot in politics. You know, if we dislike Bush, we'll look for confirming evidence why we dislike him. If we dislike Hillary, we'll look for confirming evidence to convince us that we are right. Now, that doesn't mean that one is right or wrong, or one is wrong necessarily, but it also means that in order to achieve real openness, it will help to understand how the mind often works. And instead of ignoring, discarding, confirming, or creating reality, let's try and look at it objectively, very hard. And maybe it's okay, so, you know, I don't like Bush or I don't like Hillary, but you know what they did there, the law that they passed, that was actually pretty good. Something to think about. But this is only part of the model. After we perform, motivated or not, the mind looking for consistency, there is only one thing left for us to do, and that is to interpret. To interpret our performance. Did I get an A on the exam? Or did I get a C on the exam in math? Did the person actually help or not? Did this fall or did it stay stuck in the air? All that is left after we perform is to interpret. And there are two kinds of interpretation. One is the objective interpretation. The other is the subjective interpretation. Because here, the mind works as well. In other words, this objective means, did I get an A or a C? But the interpretation can also be subjective. Does an A or a C mean I'm not good at math, or good at math, or does it mean I didn't work that hard, I can do better next time? It could mean two things. In other words, the interpretation isn't only dependent on performance. It comes from our belief. In turn, how we interpret then reinforces the belief. Let me tell you a story about interpretation, one of my favorites. Thomas Edison, arguably the most creative scientific genius of all time. He actually registered 1,097 patents, by far more than anyone else. So he's best known, you know, for the light bulb, for the film projector, if he were only here. But 1,097 other inventions in terms of building materials. A lot to do also with communication. Certainly a genius. And here is a story told about his most famous invention, the light bulb. So he was working on creating the light bulb, generating light from electricity, and he was doing it alongside the rest of the scientific community. They were all working very hard on it. And when he was working on it, after a while, he was interviewed by a reporter from 15 Minutes, I'm kidding, from the Science Journal. And the journalist came to Thomas Edison and said to Thomas Edison after they talked for a long time, Mr. Edison, you've been working on the light bulb for many years. The rest of the scientific community has been working on the light bulb for many years. You know, give it up already. You know, enough. Let's continue using kerosene and you know, that's the way of the future. It's impossible to generate light from electricity. And we have proof, you know, the entire scientific community, and you yourself too. You have conducted over 5,000 experiments, which is true, over 5,000 experiments, and you have failed 5,000 times. To which Edison responded, excuse me? What did you say? Now, Edison was really hard of hearing. One of his inventions One of his inventions is the hearing aid. And conveniently, he used it. Excuse me, what did you say? And he said, you have failed 5,000 times. Give it up. To which Edison responded, I haven't failed 5,000 times. I have succeeded 5,000 times. I've succeeded in showing what doesn't work. Same objective performance, 5,000 experiments. Well, many more if you count the entire scientific community. 5,000 performance that did not generate light from electricity. The objective interpretation, but Thomas Edison knew that it was possible. In fact, he actually set a date, a public date, where he said, I'm going to display my invention before his invention was ready. He believed that it was possible. And the belief and expectations led to a very different interpretation of the same objective events. Thomas Edison himself said, I failed my way to success. I failed my way to success. There is no other way to success. And this goes back to this great point that you brought up about section here. There is no other way to succeed. One of the mantras that I repeat to myself that has helped me a lot and that I'm going to repeat in this class again and again, learn to fail or fail to learn. There are no shortcuts. It is no coincidence that the most creative, effective, scientific genius of all time was also the scientist who failed the most times. It is no coincidence. It is no coincidence that the most successful politicians, business people, are the people who have failed the most times. We don't hear about these failures. We hear more about the successes. But read their biographies. And we'll talk about some of them when we talk about perfectionism. It is no coincidence that Babe Ruth, the person who at the time hit the most home runs out of any other player, was also the player for those years where he hit the most home runs, was also the player who was struck out the most. No coincidence. Most strikeouts related, highly correlated with most home runs. Learn to fail or fail to learn. Dean Simonton from UC Davis researched the most creative scientists and the most creative artists of all time. You know what he found? That the most creative and the most successful artists and scientists in the two domains also had the most failures. They had the most, so to speak, duds in terms of failed paintings or sculptures or attempts at inventions than any other people in the world. Learn to fail and fail to learn. And going back to the environment here, you know what one of the problems is, that one of the reasons why there is unhappiness here? It's because we haven't failed enough. I mean it. We haven't failed enough. We've always been so successful. I know coming to Harvard, you know, I was on upward trend towards success, doing well academically, sports, getting approval. We didn't fail enough. And when we don't fail enough, we're scared of failure. We don't take risks. We avoid. We don't speak up in section because what if they don't like me? What if they think I said something stupid? We do not try out for a play, perhaps, because what if I don't make it? We don't go for the things that we want to go for because we say, what if we fail? And by the way, this doesn't have to be on the conscious level. It can be subconscious, something playing, a record playing back here. We're not even hearing it. But there is no other way to succeed. Learn to fail or fail to learn. Not just for success, as Edison did, but also for happiness. And we'll talk more about it in a few minutes. Marty Seligman, considered by many the father of the positive psychology movement, has been researching optimists and pessimists for many years. And what he found was interesting. He found that in terms of achieving their goals, pessimists were realistic in terms of their short-term goals, their expectations became true, and also in terms of their long-term goals. Pessimists were realistic. Optimists, on the other hand, were unrealistic when it came to their short-term goals. They were, however, realistic when it came to their long-term goals. Let me try and make sense of this interesting finding. First of all, the pessimists. Low levels of expectations and beliefs. Things won't work out. Low levels of motivation. The mind, again, I'm simplifying here. The mind looks for consistency, and then they perform as they expected. Their interpretation is, you see, I told you. And they continue along the same path. And everyone around them says, yes, how wonderfully realistic you are. You did tell us. But now comes the optimist. Oh, and by the way, the pessimist sometimes succeeds more than he or she expected. But then over time, with interpretation, oh, I was lucky. Oh, the sun was in front of Venus, and that only happens once every 300 years. She's never going to say yes again. All right. Can we move on, please? Do you mind? Just so. Let's look at the optimists. The optimist, high levels of beliefs and expectations, very motivated, I can do it. High levels of consistency, the mind looks for consistency, and then performance, no, didn't succeed as I expected. Didn't do as well as I thought I did. And the objective interpretation should be, I failed, but I believe that I can do well. And what have I learned from this? How can I improve? What opportunity has this failure presented me with? What have I learned from it? How can I turn this into a stepping stone? And I continue around the loop again with high levels of beliefs, motivation, the mind looks for consistency. Perform, still not good, not as expected. But my interpretation is still positive. And what does everyone else around me? We're talking about the environment. What is everyone telling me? Get real. Come down to earth. Why can't you be as realistic as your good brother or sister, the pessimist? But the optimist believes. The idealist. No, I can do it. I will continue. And again, going around the loop, again, 5 times, 10 times, sometimes 5,000 times, or 10,000 times, which is how many times it took Edison to invent the light bulb, over 10,000 experiments. Going around the loop again and again until, in the long run, the beliefs and the performance match each other, not because the optimist lowered levels of beliefs, but because the optimist raised reality to match his or her levels of beliefs. With persistence, with hard work, over time, after many failures, sometimes, raise levels of performance to match beliefs. No shortcuts, no easy 5 steps, and it sometimes does take 10,000 times around the loop, but it's no coincidence that the most successful people, whether it's athletes, or scientists, or artists, are also the ones who were prepared to fail the most. Learn to fail or fail to learn. So do apply it. This is an applied class. In section, have you been, well, they're starting today, but in this class and in other classes, have you been afraid of speaking up? Get out of your comfort zone. Speak up. Were you afraid of trying out for a play or for a team? Try it. And we'll talk about the importance of coping as opposed to avoiding. Marty Seligman shows that people with high levels of optimism, and he has a lot of research on it, his book called Learned Optimism, which I recommend, he talks about how they're more resilient, they're more motivated, they work harder, and therefore they're more successful. He also shows how people who are more optimistic are less likely to be depressed. In fact, 8 times less likely to be depressed. And the important thing that he shows is that pessimism is not, again, pessimism is not something that you're born with, and nor is optimism. Yeah, we're all born within a range. There are certain people, you know, who are born with a smile and are more optimistic, but we're given a range, and within this range, we can change a lot. And we can learn to move more and more toward the optimistic side. And we're going to talk about today how we can do that, or at least begin to do that. Because he's not advocating, well, Pollyanna, pink, you know, pink-colored glasses, not at all. What he's advocating is strong, realistic sense of optimism, which I'll discuss in a minute. Because you see, there's a problem. There's a problem when we talk about optimism. Because this whole area of the power of the mind, beliefs of self-fulfilling prophecy, has been taken up by the self-help movement, what we see are a lot of misconceptions. And the question is, how do we optimize optimism? How do we optimize optimism? How can we find the right levels of belief? Because at times there are unrealistic levels of belief, and that's beliefs, and that's not healthy. Let me tell you a quick story. I may be revealing a bit too much here, but whatever, I'm getting out of my comfort zone. Her name, what? Her name was Rina. She was a showgirl. At least to me, she was. You see, we had a lot in common, Rina and me. We were both in our teens. She was 14, I was 12. I was in love with her. She too was in love with herself. We were both in our fives. She was 5'6", I was 5'1". And I loved her so. Now, my mom and I, you know, moving along, were very close. I would always come home and talk to her about the things I was going through in school, and, you know, she was always very supportive, and, you know, she really believed in me. And I came home from school and I told her, Ima, I'm in love with Rina. And she asked about her, and I told her, you know, there's a problem. She's older, taller, looks much better than I look, etc., etc. And everyone wants her in school. My mom went on a campaign, a positive thinking campaign. Though she had never read Napoleon Hill, she said, Tal, whatever you conceive and believe, you can achieve. Though she had never read Bandura or Nathaniel Brandon, she said to me, Tal, self-concept is destiny. She said to me, Tal, if you believe in her and you hold your head up high, and I had to hold my hand up very high, she said, she will want you. She will want you. And I believed. I believed. And I closed my eyes. I closed my eyes and focused. I could do it. I knew I could. I was ready. And so I went. I went to meet Rina. And unfortunately, the music stopped. Rina and I became very close. In fact, so close that she would tell me about all her unworthy, shallow, and tall boyfriends. Now, I'm not belittling what my mom did for me. I had a 24/7 Marvel Collins at home. I really did. But what I also want to bring up is the importance of realistic optimism. So, what is realistic optimism? What is the difference between, what is the difference between a strong level of beliefs and a detached level of belief? Because it's not always healthy to be, quote unquote, too optimistic, to be detached. And I think what captures it best for me is what's called, some of you know about it, the Stockdale paradox. Stockdale paradox, what is it? James Stockdale, the highest ranking prisoner of war, was an admiral in the Vietnam War. When he came out, he survived the very harsh prison conditions. When he came out, he said something very profound. He said, let me tell you about the kind of people who survived the very harsh conditions as a POW. And later they found that the same applies also to people who were more likely to survive concentration camps. Very, very, very difficult conditions. And he said, they had two characteristics. On the one hand, they had belief. They had faith. Some religious faith, but not only. They really believed that they would get out, that things would turn out well. But the people who only believed that did not make it or were less likely to make it. The other characteristic that was necessary was a strong sense of realism. A sense of realism which he described like the scientist's sense of realism. So on the one hand, they had the religious person's belief, and on the other hand, the scientist's realism. So they didn't say, oh, we'll get out by Christmas. Those who thought, yeah, we'll get out, the war's gonna be over next year, or by the end of this year, didn't make it. Unrealistic beliefs, and they broke. But the people said, we'll get out, it may be hard, it is hard, but we'll get out, we'll make it. We'll live to tell the tale. Realistic optimism. They were the ones who made it. Think about how this applies to success. Think about how it applies to, for example, athletes. You know, unrealistic would be, I'm gonna become the world champion. All I need to do is believe and conceive and then I'll become it. Versus the realistic one who says, I believe that I can be a top player. Now, it's gonna take a lot of hard work. It's gonna take a lot of failure, learn to fail or fail to learn. And then I can do it, combining belief with realism. The the problem is, you see, that positive beliefs in and of itself is not enough. And the books that were out there about the power of the mind were very inspiring, but they were misleading as well. Abraham Maslow said, and I quote, and you have this if you download the PowerPoints. I don't have it. But what he says is that if we truly believe, too much optimism, he says, and I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember the exact quote, too much optimism leads to unhappiness and does not lead to success. So it's important to temper the optimism with a sense of reality. What is the sense of reality? And here I'm going to share with you what I believe to be the secret to success. The miracle of success the secret that has been tried time and again by people throughout history. Thousands of years ago or today, it's a formula that works. The secret to success. It comprises three pillars. Optimism, passion, hard work. This is the secret to success. There hasn't been a successful person, or hardly a successful person in history, who didn't have these three components. Belief in themselves or in their cause, a passion, a love for what they were doing, and a willingness, in theory and in practice, to work extremely hard, to perspire. As Edison says, there is no substitute for hard work. Does luck play a factor here? Yes, it does. But as Thomas Jefferson said, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find that the harder I work, the luckier I get. Sure, luck plays a factor, and you're going to read an article called The Luck Factor. What are the underlying components of luck? And they're not mystical. They're real. And they have to do a lot with the belief, with hard work, and with passion. So optimism is wonderful. It's great. Belief in oneself is effective. We're going to talk about next time about how optimism actually leads to higher levels of happiness. We're going to talk about how it leads to longevity. People live longer who are optimists, significantly longer. So why doesn't every parent tell his or her kid, whatever you want, you can achieve? Or why doesn't every teacher behave like Marvel Collins? A lot of it is not because of bad intentions. Some of it comes to protect the child. Why? Why to protect the child? Because high expectations can very often lead to disappointment. And the parent wants to protect the child, doesn't want him or her to be disappointed, doesn't want him or her to fail. So I'll have lower expectations. You should have lower expectations. And then it will not hurt your self-esteem, your levels of happiness. This is conventional wisdom. And conventional wisdom is supported by some very serious thinkers in the field, some very serious psychologists. In fact, psychologist who's named after the psychology building, William James. Okay, it was bad, all right, you can still sit. Here is what William James said. William James said that self-esteem is equal to success over pretensions. In other words, how well we do over what we aspire to achieve. In other words, according to William James, if I aspire, just to take a numerical example, I mean, it's a silly example, but let's take it. Let's say my pretensions, my aspiration is to make $4,000 a month. That's my aspiration. But I end up only making $3,000 a month. According to William James, my self-esteem will be 0.75. You can't really measure it, but according to this formula, and he actually has this formula in his book. On the other hand, if my aspiration is to make $2,000 a month, and I end up making $2,000 a month, even though I'm making less than I'm making here, because of low aspirations, my self-esteem is higher than it is in this case. It's one. And this has become conventional wisdom. But what over the last 30 years, what research has shown was that this is wrong. William James was actually wrong in this case. Why? Let's look at a graph. Going back, let's say this is my levels of self-esteem, and this is time. How does it work in life? Self-esteem, also happiness. I start here, and I take a midterm, and I do poorly on my midterm. What's going to happen when I do poorly on a midterm? My self-esteem and my happiness are going to suffer. Natural human nature. After a while, though, going to go up to base level of happiness. Remember the Gilbert research. I take another midterm, math 55 this time, and I do well. What's going to happen to my self-esteem? It's going to go up. But after a while, I go back to my base level. I move on, and let's say I'm 12 years old, and I meet Rena in the street, and I ask her out, and she says, no, what will happen to my self-esteem and happiness? Will go down a bit. And then what research has shown and what my experience has shown is that after a while, you go back up again to base level. And then you walk in the street, I'm 13 years old, and I see Rena's twin sister. And she says, I love you. And what happens to my self-esteem and happiness? You guessed it. Even taller than this. But then after a while, it goes back down again. And so on, ups and downs, the vicissitudes on life, a base level of happiness and well-being. The external doesn't matter a lot to the internal. So if this is not right, so how do we get the base level up? And here is the key point. The way we get the base level up is not by having low expectations. It's through coping. Coping. By putting ourselves on the line, by trying, by pushing ourselves, by going out of our comfort zone for a while. And yes, we'll have a lot of ups and downs, a lot of failures, but the graph will look this way. With the base level going up. We'll talk about this graph because it's a very important one. So if we cope, if we get out of our comfort zone, if we try things, learn to fail or fail to learn, not only will we be more successful, but over time, our self-esteem and happiness will be higher. One of the reasons why, I mean, there are many reasons, but one of them is because we see ourselves as someone who is doing all these things, who is not afraid, who has courage. And it updates our mental schema. Self-esteem is a mental schema, that's all it is. It's a schema that we have about ourselves. So if we see ourselves trying and coping and getting up after we fall, it will actually enhance our levels of self-esteem over time. There'll be ups and downs, there'll be failures, there'll be disappointments, sure. Permission to be human. But overall, it will go up. So here is the question. So we know one thing. How do we get? One thing is to cope, to raise our levels of belief. One of the other reasons why coping helps so much is because once we fail many times, we suddenly realize hey, you know, it's not that bad. Why? Because the fear of failure, or rather the pain associated with the fear of failure, is much greater than the actual pain of failure in most cases. Let me repeat that. The pain associated with the fear of failure, what we imagine, what we think will happen, is much greater than the pain of actual failure. Because ultimately we go back to our base level of happiness. Now, it doesn't mean that there are failures that don't hurt us for a very long time and they're with us. Absolutely there are. But again, generally, as a whole, coping leads to higher levels of self-esteem. How do we raise our beliefs in ourselves? So I hope I've convinced you that it's a good thing. And again, I don't need to convince you. I think most people know that. How do we raise levels of beliefs in a healthy manner? I'm going to talk about three aspects. The first aspect I'm going to be talking about for raising levels of beliefs is this idea that Bandura talks about coping, actual action, taking action, becoming more successful, and as a result of that success, actually raising our beliefs, which leads to an upward spiral. And I'll elaborate on it next time. The second topic that I'll talk about for raising levels of beliefs is our mind, the imagination, the power of imagination, using our mind's eye as a simulator towards success. Some fascinating research done on this stuff. A lot of it here, Professor Stephen Coslin, the head of our department. And the third thing that I'll talk about is research taken from cognitive therapy. Cognitive therapy shown to be the most effective intervention, therapeutic intervention, not always for very extreme cases of depression or anxiety or other mental disorders, but certainly for most interventions for depression and for anxiety. And we'll talk about some of these techniques that we can actually apply. I'll see you on Thursday.